There will be no more killing. This is the end of death in this palace. And it is time for a new beginning. Bear ways, not human.
Welcome to Kinfolk Lore, a podcast where we explore a fictional world to bring people together. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul. And we're cousins who love to talk about world building and sci-fi and fantasy. We hope over time, through our shared love of our favorite stories, we all become family on this podcast journey.
For our first season, we are discussing His Dark Materials, the HBO BBC television show. Today, we're going to go through the episode and talk about our reflections on this world. So if you haven't watched His Dark Materials Episode 7, The Fight to the Death, please stop. Watch it and come back when you finish.
In addition, we will be discussing adult themes and topics on this podcast. But please do not choke out your children just because it's the best place in the world, okay? We want you to be safe out there. They got agencies for that stuff. This is episode 7.
We open the episode with a very cool shot of Mrs. Coulter and the Golden Monkey looking at what's left of the intercision machine. Spoiler, not much. Mrs. Coulter is beyond displeased.
Pissed!
She goes outside to find Sister Clara, who was the creepy nurse from the previous episode, and asks her if she knows where Lyra went. Sister Clara doesn't even know who Lyra is.
No, she knows Lizzie Brooks. That's what she's like. She's being genuine. She's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And Mrs. Coulter is not happy about that.
Yeah, this whole sequence was crazy. So she just kind of, you know, she's dead in the eye. So she just repeats back to Mrs. Coulter, this is the best place you could possibly be. And then...
I'm sorry. This sequence
is hilarious. Mrs. Coulter loses it. Like, just loses it. Basically attacks her. Starts choking her. Is she choking her or smothering her?
It looked like choking. Like, she had her hands wrapped around her neck, so I don't think she had anything over her face, so it had to be choking. Yeah, it was choking.
Yeah, and then she just stops. I actually thought at first she killed her, but she did not. Demonstrating that she has no problem ordering the murders of other people, but she can't bring herself to do it. I have a lot of questions about this. I do think that this woman's situation is really particularly sad. You know, Mrs. Coulter took her demon from her, which is why she's dead in the eyes and doesn't really have any sense of agency. She doesn't know what to do. I mean, she just doesn't know what to do.
But to quote Culty, we took your demon, not your brain. Like, you know, like I was like... I'm sorry. This sequence was hilarious until the very end to me. Because I was like, Mrs. Coulter's rage and who she is as a person, we've already seen it multiple times. But it felt like super heavy-handed. Like, we're going to see her go crazy. Like, and I think it also, but it also shows, I felt like that girl was a stand-in for what she wanted to do to Lyra. You ever have those moments where you just like, man, I'm going to lose it on somebody, and you just project? That's what this was. She was like, I don't care that you... And she was choking Lyra in that moment. She was not choking that nurse.
Yeah, she... I mean, definitely, she's just her every... She's taking in her failure. I mean, this... She's just failed at everything she tried. She always tries to be one step ahead. Yeah. In this case, a, you know, 11, 12-year-old girl got the best of her. Her machine is broken. Her lab is in ruins. The children have escaped.
Yeah.
You know, she's got to know the Magisterium is going to be pissed. So, you know, this woman was kind of a proxy for Lyra, for all of the things that have fallen apart because of Lyra. Not to say that I think she actually would choke Lyra. I mean, who knows at this point, but... Yeah, I think you're totally right.
Well, who knows? From the preview, she from the preview for the next thing, which I know we're jumping way, way ahead, she's like shooting at Lyra. So who knows? We have no idea. From what I saw in the thing, the preview for the next episode, I was like, what is going on? Anyway, but continue. I don't want to like throw us there.
Okay, so in the next scene, Lyra and Pan wake up in a snowy ditch. Lyra seems a little bit hurt, but she's not badly hurt, which is crazy to me because she literally fell out of the sky. But we'll talk about that in a moment.
Go, go, Gadget, snow boots.
Lyra starts to call out for Yorick, but what happens is another bear appears instead. This bear escorts Lyra to a prison cell where she asks the alethiometer where Yorick is. It tells her that he's on his way to rescue them. In the cell, she meets Johim Santelia, who is a scholar, he tells her. And she asks him if he's seen her father. He says that Azrael was permitted by Yofer to return to his laboratory to conduct his heretical experiment. I loved how Jonathan put that. He was like, his heretical experiment. And he basically tells her some history about Yorick and Yofer and why they don't, you know, why Yofer really hates Yorick. And basically that Yorick can't save her because he'll be killed as soon as he arrives at the palace. Yorick is indeed riding towards Lyra, and she sits there sitting in the cell thinking about her escape plan. She tells Jotham that she heard that Yofer desperately wants to be human. Jotham says that that's why he was hired, that he told, then he was imprisoned because he told Yofer that he could not be human, that he would only ever be a bear. And he says, unless you're a witch who can magic him a demon, you will fail to please him, just as I have, which triggers an idea in Lyra's mind. And she demands to speak to Yofer and uses Yorick's name to get attention from the guards.
And then that guy is like, you're just like your father. And he goes into a crazy laugh. Like, he's like, whoa, what just happened here?
Yeah, so I was getting... Okay, so the Harry Potter movies are kind of controversial to Harry Potter fandom, but I think even people who don't like the movies all agree that the third movie, Prisoner of Azkaban, is the best one. I seriously felt like this guy watched Sirius Black in Prisoner of Azkaban and was channeling his best Sirius Black, because Sirius Black is a great character in Harry Potter, but when he's first introduced, he just seems like a lunatic escaped prisoner. Yeah. And that's what this guy just seemed like, a lunatic to me. Yeah. I was like, what? He's like maniacally laughing.
Yeah. Yeah.
When she tells him her name, he like starts cackling. I was just like, yeah. What?
Yeah. I'm sorry. There is so much comedy in this first sequence. I'm not trying to kill him, but man, there is so much happening here. First of all, let's talk about the stuff that I really enjoyed. I do enjoy like seeing like what damage Lyra had done, like the wake that the kids left and the Egyptians left behind, that the whole place, Bolvanger is wrecked. It is irreparable damage. They're not gonna, all those years of building that machine, of figuring out their experiments, there's like destruction and death of all the people, most of the people that were responsible. And so you got to say that the Egyptians did meet their goal, right? So that's pretty cool that they did.
Yeah, I mean, the wreckage of the intercision machine alone was devastating. That opening shot is beautiful. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, it's just Mrs. Coulter and the Golden Monkey taking in the devastation that is Lyra and Pan blowing that machine up. Mm-hmm. It's great to see that. The set design in this thing and the way that they have shot a lot of the scenes is just beautiful. And this was a great opening scene.
Yeah. And so then let's talk about how one Lyra Belacqua, who becomes another name later in the episode, falls out of a balloon at peak height and lands on not a very big patch of snow and is still alive and fully intact. I'll defer to my cousin here to talk about your thoughts on this.
I was so mad at this. There were so many ways to make this work.
Yeah.
I said last week, we know Lyra's fine, so I didn't like the way that this last episode ended.
Yeah.
But okay, you're going to have her fall out the balloon in this way, but it seems like the balloon's pretty far from the ground at this point.
100%.
And all they had to do was make like a larger mountain of snow. So it looked like when she fell on a lot of snow. I didn't feel like this was enough. Like, she would have died. There's no
100%
way.
100% she would have died in that level of snow. And the other thing is they could have, like, you and I, you know, spoke a little offline about this, but we'll say it here, is this was a piece in the book they did not need to change. The way that it happens in the books was that the balloon is under attack by the same things that were attacking them in the show. The balloon takes some damage, goes down to the ground, and while it's down on the ground, she falls out of the basket, and then it rises back up, and he can't go down and get her, so that's where she gets left. And that could have just simply been how it is. The dramatic fall at the end of the episode, where we were like, why does she always have to be in peril at the end of an episode, is where this goes left, because it sets them up to have to figure out, well, where is she landing, you know?
Yeah, again, as I said last week, when you get people thinking about the how, you're taking them out of the fantasy aspect. This was unnecessary.
I will say
that the very next scene where she's being escorted to the palace, this palace was incredible.
Yes.
Like, it was super foreboding. The masonry of it, and then also like the white black backdrop of the snow, and then to see all of that blood on the steps. I mean, this was really well designed. It's just beautiful.
Yeah.
But just it didn't make up for the prior scene, but it quickly distracted me from being like, why is Lyra alive? I'm confused.
Yeah, exactly. It does. They get you there really quick. You're like, oh wait. Like a new bear. She's like actually meeting all the Svarbar bears. And oh wait, there's blood on the stairs. That's a lot of blood. You know what I mean? Like, what are they killing in there? And yeah, so it does change your, it does get you off of the, what should have been certain death for Lyra pretty quickly. I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah. And I think, what I left out of my summary, just because it doesn't seem to be important in this sequence, but I believe that Boreal also was crossing over back into our world somewhere in here. So that was just like a quick scene where we see him doing the thing that he's done 100 times before, which is cross into our world.
It's becoming like pretty status quo for him now. It's like going.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like going to the mall for him. Yeah. He's like, you know, I need to pick something up. I'm just going to swing over to 2019. The world that the people who are watching this show live in, and see how things are going over there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing that's really cool about this too is what's in your summary is that the way that she meets the bears, gets in the cell, meets Jotham, but I really like you see her wheels turning in her head about how am I gonna save Urich? You know, because she's like, how do I figure this out? Because he's running. She almost intuitively knows from all the history they've shared throughout the season and throughout this time that he's going to come and try to save her. And she's thinking already, okay, what? And then she has that moment of like, oh, this guy wants to be human. He wants a demon. And to see that all happen non-verbally, great job by Daphne Keene. She killed it as far as the acting and the performance. And I think you can really see Lyra as the character, like, figuring out how she's going to save Urich. You know?
Yeah, you could definitely see the wheels turning in her head. She's getting information. She's analyzing it. She's using the alethiometer when she needs to. And then she's concocting an idea. This is one of the things I love the most about Lyra's character. She is able to think quickly on her feet for the most part. And she does that in this first scene, these first scenes very well.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, that's really cool. So, in the next segment, we got Boreal, who's crossed back into our world. Once again, like we just talked about, is watching video of John Parry before his expedition. John Parry mentions that he's going to be writing some pretty epic letters. And now Boreal's got an idea. Wait, so if this guy wrote epic letters to his wife and child, maybe they're still around somewhere. Cut to Lyra coming face to face with Yorfor, who's looking for a real, real extra on the throne. Real extra.
I was, yeah, like, I was like, this guy could not look more like, I am king.
Yeah, yeah. He's overcompensating for something. I don't know what he is, though. Like, for sure. Like, and then all of that, all of the, again, like, accentuating in there, all the, in the throne room, all the blood on the floor, the bears on the side, eating these carcasses. I guess venison is all the craze in the bear community. It's a lot of deer. A lot of deer going on. But yeah, so then she tells Yofort that she's Yurik's demon. Humans get animal demons so it only makes sense for bears to get human demons. That is a really, really good stroke of genius by Lyra to come up with that. She tells Yofort that she would rather be his demon than Yurik's demon, using the cover of Mrs. Coulter's experiments, saying that in addition to child cutting, Mrs. Coulter found a way to find to create artificial demons. She tells him that Yurik is on the way to fight him. Yofort isn't super bright, so he tries to like figure out what he should do to test her, and he says, you know what? I'm going to ask you, what was the creature that I first killed? She demands some privacy, that when she's his demon, she'll let him know exactly how she does this, but until then, she needs privacy to be able to do it. He falls for this, lets her go behind a brick pillar, and then she asks the alethiometer to tell her how his what was the first creature that he killed. She comes back with the information. She plays this really well, you know, oh, great king, I didn't know that you were so powerful. And she really lays it on thick, and then lets him know that, you know, the first thing that Yofort killed was his father. And he gets really upset about this because that is in fact true. So he now knows that Mrs. Coulter was lying to him or believes that.
Pause for a second here. But he was also lying to her.
Yeah.
He's like real tight. Mrs. Coulter lied to me. And I'm like, right, but you're like, Asriel's supposed to be in prison. Like,
apparently the patriarchy is alive and well in the bear community as well. It's one-sided over there. He's sitting here like, hey, you know what? I can lie to her, but she can't lie to me. It's very, very funny, his whole sense of justice in this moment. I agree with you. It was wild, super duper wild. And I also think that, he's like, so, for not being able to trick a bear, like Yurik said, he's pretty fucking gullible.
He's so dumb. I just had no respect for him right away. I was like, you are not. This guy's not smart.
She's all like, he's all like, do it here. She's like, I'll do it when I'm your demon. And let's also say that Lyra is pretty courageous in this moment, because if you're her, you're 12 years old, you're walking through a throne room, like full of blood, seeing animals kill their prey, and you're still like, this shows you the love she has for Yurik. She's like, I'm still going through with this plan, because if not, I know Yurik is done for sure. You know, so I like that about her. It's good on her. Being all
smart. No, she, Lyra's brilliant here. It's just, Yofor is not the smartest.
Dull. Not the sharpest tool in the shed. Not at all. Like,
no, not the smartest.
Not at
Little
all.
Little girl's just lying her way through, and he's like, very. I mean, he gave her this test, but then she's like, I need to do it in private. I'm like, I'd be like, what? I don't know.
Like, okay, all right, open book test. No problem. Go ahead. It's fine. You don't need it. That's funny. He doesn't, I mean, obviously, he doesn't know she has the alethiometer, which is kind of great for her. So after this, Lyra tells Yofort to tell the other bears that it was his idea to summon Yurik. That way, basically, he can like make it seem like he's the one that's still in control, which apparently is a big issue for Yofort. So Lyra wants to go off so she can try to, like, you know, warn Yurik or do something, and Yofort is like, no, you have to stay with me while I get ready for battle. So that happens, and then we get to Boreal, who is returning to Will's house. And essentially pushes his way in to talking to Will's mom. Tries to start off with being like smooth Boreal again, like kind of like, Elaine, how are you? Like, isn't that?
Yeah. He definitely was trying to talk his way in, and she was not having. She was like, nope.
No. It was kind of creepy, though. He just, like, turns the door and, like, the stare off between the two of them. Like, she didn't get to the lock as soon as he could turn the door. Pretty creepy stuff. And then so at that point, he essentially, you know, pushes through and tells Elaine that he has an urgent information about her husband, but can't, but he can't tell her from the porch. Like, there's no way that that's going to happen. So he tries to get in. Boreal tells Elaine once he's in that he knows that she has a son, Will, and that he has no intention of harming him. He suggests that he is an intelligence officer, and he's investigating John's disappearance, that John has some valuable objects. He says that if the information is correct, that John could actually still be alive, giving her that sense of hope. He brings up the letters to Elaine that he's looking for, and Elaine resists right away. She knows her rights and tells Boreal that if he wants to search, he's better get a warrant, you know?
I love this so much.
Yeah.
I love that. She was like, listen, I have seen Law and Order. I have seen the procedural TV shows. I know my rights.
Or at least listen to 99 Problems. At least listen to 99 Problems. But he's like, I know my rights. You're going to need a warrant for that. Quoting Jay-Z, Hov is in the building. Anyway. So she's like up on her legalese, doesn't let it happen. And Boreal has like a wild like maneuver around this. He drops the name of Her Majesty the Queen. What's going on? Like, what? So now you're saying that Queen Elizabeth II has sent you on a special mission to find these records? Pretty wild stuff.
I mean, he was essentially invoking like Her Majesty's government needs. I just watched The Crown, so I was a little
upset. I was a little upset too.
How dare you?
Oh my god. So as he's telling her this, she sees the snake demon, and that's pretty much where it ends their conversation. And Boreal promises to return. He basically says that was a figment of her imagination. My thought process in that was, did he do that intentionally or not? I guess we could talk about that. Like, do you think he flashed the snake on purpose, or was he so angry that the snake came out?
I was trying to figure that out too. I think I have decided that this is a intimidation tactic,
yeah.
But I'm not sure. I'm not sure if this was like, she kind of got him frazzled, and so he wasn't as good at hiding his true self, right? The snake is a representation of his true self, and so I couldn't tell if this was the snake came out because Boreal was showing his true face,
yeah,
or if he was trying to intimidate her. It was hard to tell.
Yeah, I felt like it was hard to tell too, but I'll roll with that. I'll roll with he was trying to intimidate her because it feels like that's within his character. Yeah, for sure that is. And then Boreal gets back in the car. He leaves, gets back in the car with, you know, his minions over there and starts talking to him. And he doesn't care how they do it, but he needs to get those letters. He makes it very clear. Those guys need to figure out how to get the letters so he can find out what Grumman, a.k.a. John Perry, is doing.
Yeah, this was... Boreal. Okay, so let's just talk about the exchange between Boreal and Elaine. I was, all jokes aside, I was really proud of her.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, really proud of her. She was not, when he brought up the letters, she was like, nope. When he started saying he was in a search, she was like, you better get a warrant. She really shut him down. She basically, you know, challenged him. Like, I'm not going to give you anything. So if you want these things, you need to take it by force. And I think that exchange is what instigates what happens in the following scenes, because he realized that he can't be all slivery and slimy with her, that she's not going to have it. She's not so fragile that she can't stand up to him. I was really impressed with her here.
Yeah, I agree. And here's the thing, though. I find more and more as I watch that Elaine is not as not fragile at all, honestly. I think, like, she's the one who knows the game and everybody else is coming into it. Like, she knows, she's kind of seen Boreal for what he is. Like, you could be one of these people that have information, yeah, but you could also be somebody who's trying to trick me to make things worse for me. And I think, like, yeah, she has some issues, but what's really wild to me is I think that she's more on point than most of the people that are in our world. Like, she understands what's really happening, you know?
She definitely, I mean, whatever's in those letters, it definitely gave Elaine some information that that she understands is both sensitive information and also information that is not widely known. And so I think that, I'm not sure what we'll find in the letters, right? Who knows how explicit John was and how much she had to sort of read between the lines and she understood it. But clearly, she knows that those letters are worth being protected. She knows that there's something in them that could be dangerous, right? If Will also knew the contents. And I'm pretty impressed with how the show has built out her character, because I think that while she clearly does have some mental health issues, she's been on point. Like, she hasn't said anything that is not true. These are not hallucinations, and the urgency by which she's operating is the same urgency that Will needs to operate, and he doesn't learn that until he sees other evidence of it. So I really like the way that Elaine is being portrayed, and the fact that she can't be duped by Boreal, even though she's presented as being kind of like weak-minded, is great. You know, like, Boreal is, he's being pretty slippery here. And so I think that the fact that she's able to resist and she gets it just shows that, one, he's not as good as it as he thinks he is, but also, two, that her paranoia, which may be a symptom of her mental illness, but it may also just be, as I said, when she first came on the scene, this has happened before. She knows that whatever John was involved with, people would want that information. So I'm curious about whether or not Boreal is the first person to come knocking on her door or not.
I doubt it, just based on how she presented. I'm with you. I mean, we have no proof or evidence of it, but it feels like she's had to deal with this while Will was growing up, probably more than Will even knows. And that's why I question the whole, I don't know. I obviously at this point she has developed mental health issues, but I guess where I'm hedging a little bit in my own headcanon is that if you keep telling people something and everybody keeps dismissing you and everybody keeps saying to you, you don't know what you're talking about, it eventually you start relating to yourself through the ideas that people have in the world. They're just saying, oh yeah, this is who you are, you're that. And you know, it's hard to fight that and combat that. And I feel like she still has that reservoir of fight in this scene that really shows, like, hey, you know what? No, I know what's going on here. I'm going to make sure that you don't get to those letters, and I'm going to make sure that you don't harm Will. You know, so it's really, really, I thought, I stand up, I'm with you on it. I like Elaine's character development.
Totally agree. Yeah, she's great. I mean, a lot happened in this. I think we already talked about the fact that Yofur is not super bright, so we probably shouldn't spend any more time on that one.
Yeah, we can leave him alone. I mean, we already talked about how reckless Boreal is in these streets, using the queen's name, dropping the name
the queen. Her majesty's government. Yeah. I was like, how dare you?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we can talk about here is that there's something that's spoken about here basically, we're saying York. I guess we can talk about York a little bit. Saying, like, I mean, not York, Yofur. One thing we can say about Yofur is that he wants to be human so bad, which in the source material kind of alludes to that's what makes him able to be tricked. And I think that's like key here, because why he can be tricked is because he's not using his bear instincts to be the king. He's using what he perceives as his desire to be accepted by the human community and the humans in this world and the magisterium and being baptized has actually made him less bear than maybe even Lyra is. When she says she's part bear, she may actually be onto something. Her time with Yorick has really informed the way she handles this situation.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And I also think it was funny that, you know, Jotham says, you're just like your father, right, to her, and she's really acting like her mother.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah,
where she's being just as duplicitous as her mother in trying to manipulate Yofur. So I thought that was, I just really, Lyra is shining really bright in this. She comes up with this plan. I don't think she's super sure of the plan, right? She's nervous about it, but she comes up with this plan. She's quick on her feet. She uses the information that's given to her. She's great here.
Yep, I agree.
All right, so Yorick arrives and speaks to Lyra briefly. I was a little confused about this because didn't Yofur tell her to stay with him in the previous scene?
Yeah, that was a little bit off-putting for me too, because I know how that happens and how she gets to do that in the books, but yeah, in the show, it felt like there's no reason why she would be there to greet Yorick when he first got there as the main person. But, you know, another reason why we're questioning how on some things with this episode.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this conversation had to happen. Yeah. So she admits that she put him in a pretty difficult situation by tricking Yofur, that she tells him that he can't, basically that she set up this fight, mm-hmm. that they're going to fight to the death, and that he can't let Yofur know that he knows anything. Meanwhile, Yofur is in the throne room talking so much trash.
Mad shit. He's just dropping. He's
just like going in. Just like, it's about to be on. Your boys is coming back. Take him out. Just talking. So I was like, okay. And the other bears are like, all right. Like, none of them are hyping him up. They're just like, okay, the king is going in again. Like, it feels like this is something he does on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So Yorick shows up and basically says, you can catch these hands. Basically, you want to fight?
You want to fight? Let's go.
Yo, let's go.
He was even like, yo, you ain't no real bear. You ain't real like that. Let's go. Let's see what's up.
Let's do this. Like, just, I'm ready. You're in here talking garbage. I'm ready. The fight is really, really, really brutal. Like, these guys are, I mean, this is clearly a fight to the death. They are not pulling punches. It just shows how much animosity exists between these two. It looks like Yorick is going to be killed for a moment. He's on his side. He's bloodied up. He's not able to get up. Lyra goes to Yorick immediately, and that is when Yofur realizes that she is not a demon and that she is actually, her allegiance is to Yorick, and he looks like he's about to pounce on her.
Mm-hmm.
Yorick is not going to let his girl go out like this. So he jumps up. He suddenly has like the strength to act, and he kills Yofur. This was interesting because of the way that the camera was focused on Lyra. I was glad about this. Like, it put the tension of that moment was really there, because she's the one who's actually freaking out about what's going to happen here. And so it's really just on her face and her trying to look away, because she thinks Yorick is dead.
Yeah.
Like, she's basically like, what have I done here? So it's clear that Yorick wins, and while she's tending to his wounds, he tells her that he basically says that he's going to give her a new name, Lyra Silvertongue, that because she was able to trick a bear, he thinks that she is now part of them, and she is pretty moved by this.
Awesome moment.
Yeah, this was a nice moment. I don't quite like the fact that he basically was like, you're one of us now, but
I mean,
but I'm down with the new name. Lyra Silvertongue is a really cool name,
and she doesn't have to even. He gave her an out. He's like, you know what? I'm gonna adopt you because your dad is trash. You don't know this yet, but your dad is like the Bellaquad name. Just be a Silvertongue. Just come on over here and be with us and the bears. I'm gonna take care of that. I'm gonna adopt you.
Yeah, I mean, this was sweet, and it also, I think, was a moment where Yorick was like, "What you did was okay because this was a necessary battle. This was fine. Like, yes, I'm hurt. You showed me who Yofur really is, that he's not really a bear in the sense that he is culturally one, right? Obviously, he was physically one, but he was easily tricked. You're more like us than he was. And so she gets adopted by the bears, which is cute. For a little girl who basically, even though both her parents are living, but she's lived as an orphan because she thought her parents were dead. A lot of people seem to want to take her under their wing, which is really nice to see. She has allies.
I agree. I love it. Should we take a moment here and just...
Oh, that's right.
Do we just pour one out for the lamest, most trickable, daftest, dumb bear just king dumb. To live? Let's pour one out for Yorfor. Yorfor Ragnarsson.
Yeah, he just... I mean, I'm glad to see the back of this guy.
Me too. Let's not pour anything good. We're just going to do this out of respect. He was a king.
He gets the cheap stuff.
He gets the cheap stuff. Exactly. Nothing good. All right.
When Yorick arrived in the throne room, I was really having this moment where I was like, this was like in Black Panther. When Killmonger was like, is this your
king? Oh, God. I can totally see that.
Okay. All right. So, where am I? Okay, so back in our world, Will is looking pretty sad at school. He is leaving and his mom shows up. He's pretty upset by this. The things that she says are actually pretty crazy sounding, right? She says a Secret Service man showed up. He had a snake. I mean, all these things sound insane, but they're true. Yeah. This is what actually happened.
Yeah.
But she catches Will's attention when she says that his father may be alive. Will is brightened by the thought and immediately takes her home. Back in Lyra's world, Yorick addresses his new subjects and tells them that there will be no more killing in their palace. That they're not going to be like men. They're going to be like bears. He takes Lyra to find Roger, who says that he fell out of the balloon with Yorick and that the last time that they saw Lee, he was still airborne, but he was in trouble. So Yorick asks Lyra to consult the alethiometer to find out about Lee. He's super concerned about his friend, which was sweet too.
Yes, very.
He was like, I just need to know that Lee is okay. Mm-hmm. And it tells her that Lee crashed, but he is safe. And also that the Magisterium is on their way with Mrs. Coulter. Lyra decides right then that she has to give the alethiometer to her father. And Yorick and Roger agree to go with her.
Why, Lyra?
Oh my God. I was so angry about this. I know this is silly to be angry about, but I was like, I'm really annoyed that she wants to give the alethiometer to Azrael and that Yorick and Roger are supposed to go through more danger for. I was so irritated. I was like, do you really want to give him the alethiometer? Like, can't you just stay in Svalbard? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, he should be able to figure it out. Everyone's special. He's special. He's got his answers. He should be fine. He should be fine. He got it all figured out, that guy. Man, yeah. I mean, I guess we'll start from the top of this section. So, I mean, I really like that exchange, honestly, even though it doesn't seem like it came out of the blue. I do like that she goes to warn Yorick, and something that's kind of like changed a little bit, but she in the source material, she feels really sad about it, and when she tells Yorick, he's really hyped about it because he's been waiting to fight Yorfor for a minute. So the fact that she's Don King this thing out and promoted it, you know what I mean? Like she's
the
like
the biggest fight of the season.
It's gonna be the spar quick in the Arctic. Let's go. Let's roll. Like is it? Yeah. So he's got it going. He's got his Thrilla and Manila thing happening. So he's happy. So I think that was really cool. I really like all the trash talk. The trash talk was epic. The two of them were like going at it before they even sparred was really cool. I don't like that they had no armor. We spent all this time talking about how the armor is like their soul and who they are. I was really concerned, like, and in the books, right? I keep referencing because there's a lot of changes in this episode from the books. And in the books, like, the reason why he's able to kill, why Yorick is able to kill Yorfor is because he finds a hole in his armor that allows him to strike a pretty fatal blow. And it's kind of like a stand-in. That hole in the armor is like a stand-in for that hole in his spirit and who he is as a leader. And the fact that he has like this desire to be something that he's not, and that his armor even has that. That armor is part of his spirit. The armor doesn't have integrity. And so taking the armor away kind of makes this just like a quick, like, two bears going at it, where there's a lot of meaning and symbolism in the fight.
Yeah, I thought the fact that they both were not wearing armor was kind of crazy, because Yofur makes this whole big thing about ready me for battle, which I assumed meant, like, you know, he was going to get his gear together. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing when we first meet Yorick is about having an armored bear, and then they're both naked.
Yeah.
When they have this fight. Yeah. But none of the other bears are. So it's not like, I was kind of like, are they trying to say that this is like a cultural thing where you fight, when you do hand-to-hand combat to the death, you do it without your armor? But it doesn't seem like it. It maybe seems like they just couldn't, honestly, to get meta, like they couldn't render the armor on the bears in a way that looked good. They just went without it. That's what it seemed like to me. Mm-hmm. So I didn't like that either.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like, just playing off of what you're saying, it's another moment where, like, my ability to suspend disbelief was altered. Like, I couldn't, where it's like her falling out of the balloon, them not wearing armor. It's like and maybe just because, you know, reading, I just saw it in my mind and I saw the whole thing, and they both had armor on. And it was like, the reason why it's so weird to me is because his armor is so played up in the earlier episodes. And also, so is Yorfor's. Like, his armor is golden and has all those things. So you just thought, oh, well, we're going to see, like, the two bears go at it and see how their armor holds up against each other. And, I just thought it was a miss by the... They've had a real rough time with battles in this show.
Yeah, and I also... Okay. This is a deeper thing I was going to talk about later, but since we're talking about the actual fight, the whole premise of this fight, from the show point of view, seems to be that Lyra constructed this fight, and that's why they're doing this. But Yorick wants this fight. Mm-hmm. This fight, and I don't feel like the show did the work with Yorick to demonstrate that he actually does want to go back. Like, the only time he's spoken about this, he was like, I was exiled, it was the right decision. You know, like, he doesn't seem like he's eager to go back, but, like, this is not a fight that he would run away from. It is a fight that is actually important. This is his way of proving himself and getting back into his community and taking away the power from this person who does, this bear, I shouldn't say person. I mean, I guess he's a person. He's not a human, but he's a person. But taking the power away from this bear who doesn't deserve it. And I just, that seemed, the motivations of Yorick here seemed almost entirely like it was about saving Lyra, and it wasn't really. Like, that's part of it, right? Like, of course, that's what brought them to this point, was that Lyra wanted to free her father, but, like, Yorick, what this was going to happen anyway. Like, meeting Lyra changed the trajectory of what he was willing to do, and he was going to, this was an inevitable battle.
100%. And the reason I think they didn't do it, and I know, like, we have focused primarily on the show and we only reference things here and there, but it has been, this episode is pretty glaring because of the amount of changes from the end of the episode to this one. And the reason why the work isn't done is because they just don't get to the point that I think our listeners should know, if you've watched the show, and maybe there's some who are only watching the show who may be a little confused and just think, oh, this is just about Lyra, is that, like, Yorfor actually set the wheels in motion for the bear that Yorick killed. He set the whole thing up so that he could show that he wasn't worthy of holding the throne as the prince and the rightful heir to the throne, because he wanted the throne. So here is a person returning to his kingdom that was rightfully his, and seeing this imposter who actually set him up, like, sitting on the throne. So this is his motivation more than anything. And he's just set into motion, it's like, by Lyra being in danger and him knowing the danger that she's in.
Right. So I don't think that, for all the character work that's been done with Ma Costa, Mrs. Coulter, all the stuff that we say is really great, right, that we like, we have lost some things. And one of the things that I think is being lost, that I noticed in the last two episodes, is both Yurik and Lee, who were introduced later, and so less character work has been done around them. Their motivations are being transcribed in a way I don't fully understand.
Agree.
And so I don't, which is interesting because we met Serafina the same time we met Lee, correct? Was it the same episode?
It was a little bit later. It was the next episode after we met Lee.
Yes, that's right. We met Serafina in the episode where they find Billy. Serafina's motivation seemed really clear to me, and she's had significantly less screen time than Yurik and Lee, but I just don't think the show has done a good job of telling the backstories of Lee or Yurik, and so it's unclear to me, like, we are not there yet, but Lee's conversation with Serafina later was confusing.
Yeah, it totally was, and I think that's some of the things that we can definitely point to of just speeding through this. One of the things as we get deeper down into the what I like, what I question, what I want to see more of, I'll talk about is just the pacing. And you know, that's one of the things that we can kind of like put on pause for the moment. But that's something I think really has hurt with what you're talking about. You know what you're
talking about. Okay. So let's come back to that later.
So at this moment, at the Magisterium, Fra Pravel asked Father Garrett, the dude with the weird bug, creepy bug demon from Mrs. Coulter's apartment, what is happening. Everyone's hurrying about. Father Garrett informs him that Yurfor is dead and Asriel is free again. How did they find out?
Who's the snitch?
I don't know.
Who is the snitch?
I don't know. I want to know who's out here snitching like
this. I'm starting to think Lyra is the snitch. Like. How do they know everything that happened so quickly? Like, the Magisterium knows information. Does the Magisterium have drones? Like, what is happening? I'm so confused about how they have this information before basically everyone
else. And before Ratty. Ratty should know. Ratty has the fucking alethiometer.
Ratty has the alethiometer.
Yeah, come on. What is going on? How does Ratty not know and they all know? Major, major problem. Like, he has the alethiometer. He could be like, whoa, I sense something going on. Like, let me ask the alethiometer. Although, he doesn't have the knowledge. He doesn't have the... He'd have to read books for, like, mad long to get the answer. But it'd still be quicker. Anyway. So, Mrs. Coulter arrives at the airfield, and Father McPhail tells her that she's failed. And that Adriel has been continuing his experiments, even though she thought he wasn't. And Mrs. Coulter is blindsided by your first betrayal. And also by his death. She was kind of shocked. She thought she had everything in hand. But she is convincing and laying out her case to Father McPhail that she has to come. Which always surprises me how convincing she can be, right? She's like, hey, everything's broke. I messed up. But you know what? I should come because I know Asriel better than any of you. Which is a fair point. Like, fair point. But still. She also says that she knows and understands dust a lot more than they do because she has studied it. Father McPhail takes stock of the cut on Mrs. Coulter's chin and tells her that Asriel is going to need to die this time. It's not going to be any, there's no talking. Talking days are done. We're finna murk this dude. It's over. It's it. Finna drive by on this Mark Button. That's what's happening right now.
Yeah, no, I thought this was interesting because he's kind of like a set. First of all, she gets all up in his personal space. Like, she's been taking notes from Boreal. Like, really close. And he's kind of looking at her. He's assessing the damage of what she's been through. Because she's coming off of her regular smooth demeanor, but she's, like, not in perfect shape, right? But he's letting her know, this is not a joke. Like, we're no more imprisoning Asriel. Asriel's got to go. He has to be eliminated.
Well, what that also insinuates, right, is that the Magisterium senses in her that maybe some of her failures, like, because if she had him with the bears and all that, she could have had him executed. Maybe some of her failures to actually pull the trigger and just get rid of Asriel altogether is that she still has a soft spot for him. You know what I mean? She still has something there for him, right? So that's insinuated in all of that.
Which, given their past relationship and the fact that they have a child together, I think that's a fair assessment.
even if he is a failure as a man and a failure as a father.
As a father.
even if that is the case. Yeah, no, I get it. That's fair. So then back in our world, Thomas is seen searching Will's house just as Will and Elaine arrive to find the place ransacked. Will takes his mother to his coach's house to get out of there. Like, let's bounce. And tells her that he believes everything she said about the letters and the man and the snake. The coach, whose name is Mr. Hanway, says they should call the police, but Will insists that he will go home, tidy up, and bring her back, and ask if the coach can just let Elaine stay there, maybe even possibly overnight. The coach says he has some stuff
extra
there,
pajamas.
Extra pajamas that she could stay in.
It was so cute. It was like, aw.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. I like the coach. You know what I mean? I like
him a lot. His instincts are good. Like, he immediately was like, okay, let's get the authorities involved. Like, mm-hmm. this, like, you guys are the victim of a crime. Mm-hmm. I do question that. I guess it's a hard position to be put in as a adult, right? He doesn't want Will, because Will basically says, I will be put in care. Like, if they find my mom in this state where she's this frazzled and she's, you know, talking about the things she's talking about, the government is going to take away her custody and I'm going to end up in care. And the coach doesn't want that to happen. So he's letting Will handle the situation on his own. But it's tough. Like, I don't know what I would do in that situation. I would hope that I would do the right thing. But what is the right thing? Like, you don't want a child put into foster care, especially a child that you have a connection with, that you know that, like, you can support in some way. But the flip side is that they're not okay. You know, when we first met the coach, Will basically promised him, we're doing okay. They're not okay. Like, something is clearly not right here. And, you know, whether or not the authorities should get involved, I think that's a tricky decision for the coach to be in. So good on him. But this was hard.
It is hard. I think he made the right call. You know, like he trusts himself to be able to be an influence in helping Will more than he trusts the government officials, right? So that's, but it's tough. It is tough. All this is tough. So somewhere in the north, Lee is rummaging through his crash balloon. Serafina shows up and tells Lee that Yorick, Lyra, and Roger are all alive. And Yorick has reclaimed his throne, which makes Lee happy.
Very happy. Yeah. That was nice to see.
Yeah, he was like super pumped for his boy. And she returns his pistol to him and tells him that there are more battles to come and that the battles are just beginning. And so then Lee has a cool line where he says, oh, this must mean that you're going to need me to fight again. And she says, you know, she kind of gives him the affirmative. Yeah, that's going to happen. Lyra's going to need you. And then after that conversation, we are treated to another scene of Yorick Bjornason galloping through the snow, this time with both Lyra and Roger on his back, still sans Cecilia or Pan. But it's okay. It's still beautiful. It's beautiful.
It is really nice. But yes, well, I have some more notes about the demons when we get to the end. Okay, I just want to address why I was confused about this. Mm-hmm. Lee and Serafina literally just had a conversation about why he needs to help Lyra. Did he think that, like, letting her fall out of the balloon and then letting Yorick clean up the mess was, like, all he had to do? I'm a little bit confused about why this conversation needed to happen after their previous conversation where he basically accepted that Lyra was in his charge.
Well, I mean, for Aeronaut, he's going to go fix his balloon first because he's like useless without it, maybe, I'm thinking. And then so maybe he thought, okay, I got to go do that. And then maybe she's already, maybe I've already failed. Like, so before he finds out that they're alive, he probably feels like, okay, she fell out of my balloon. Then Yorick fell out and Roger fell out. All of them are dead. Right? So, like, what we would be thinking, like, oh, he'd be in his rights to think it. She fell from, if not for show magic, she should probably be dead. So, I'm just saying. So, he's feeling down on himself, maybe. I don't know. That's my takeaway. That's how I took it, but I agree with you. 110%.
I just felt like Serafina already gave him the good news, and then he's kind of surprised when she's basically like, this is not over. you know, Yurik getting his throne back is great, but it has nothing to do with Lyra's mission as far as we can tell so far. So anyway, I just thought it was an odd conversation. I'm never gonna say no to a scene with Serafina. She just looks great. The acting is great. Like, I think she's really one of the best characters. Like, the way that she's been presented is exactly how I imagined her when I read the book. So I really, really like seeing Serafina. But, you know, I just didn't understand why they were... I'm a little confused about what Lee is thinking.
Yeah, me too. I don't understand his... I'm having a little bit of a hard time with that too, just in the sense that nothing has changed in his mission. You know, it should be the same. Regardless, he should be the one that's trying to get back, like Yurik was trying to get back, right? So I get that. I get that part of it.
Yeah.
We already covered kind of like what happened with the coach and the mom. I did find it interesting that like he's like going and leaving his mom with the coach, and that's his only trusted ally at this point. Very, you know, a little different than the source material, you know, like somebody who which was like a family friend. But I think it works in this sense that the coach is, you know, he's a good dude, like we covered, and he seems trustworthy. What do you think about Mrs. Coulter's ability to convince them to take her north with them to try to fight Asriel?
Okay, a couple of things about her conversation with Father McPhail. First of all, I just want to acknowledge Father McPhail is so happy to tell her she's failed. Like, no one... You ever have that person at work who, like, everyone thinks they're the best, and you're just like, this person ain't shit.
Yeah.
That's what Father McPhail feels about Mrs. Coulter. He's like, I knew it. Eventually, I get to be the one to tell her.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
He's so excited.
Exactly.
He takes glee. But... he also, I think, has moved into a point of view where he's going to use her the way that she's been using them. I mean, he asks her in this exchange, he doesn't ask her, he basically demands. He's saying, I need to make sure that what you're seeking here is to help the Magisterium. You know, I need your allegiance to the Magisterium. And she says that. But I think these two are in a relationship at this point where... they're going to use each other. So it wouldn't surprise me. I don't think that Father McPhail was convinced. I just think that he feels like it might be useful to have her. It could be that when they confront Asriel, he's not sure how Asriel feels about her either. So they could use her as a weapon against Asriel. I don't think that her little speech is like what got him. Because I don't think this guy trusts her. I mean... he was ready to get her rid of her back when he visited her apartment and was talking about the ablation board. All of that is in shambles. She has failed at everything. And so I don't think that he was totally convinced here. I think she's actually losing her ability to manipulate people. I think he just is smart enough. Unlike Yulfer, he's smart enough to recognize that he can use this to his advantage.
Agreed. No, I agree. He's played it pretty well. He's let her like fail on her own accounts. In fact, he was like, he's pretty much like this is the second time we've seen him pretty happy, and she didn't have the trick up her sleeve with having Asriel imprisoned. He would have got her over at the Magisterium that all those episodes back. So yeah, no, I agree with you. I totally agree.
All right, so back in our world, Will arrives back home. He immediately goes to find the letters. They're still hidden in the same place, so we know that the intruders did not get them. Lyra, Roger, and Yurik arrive at Asriel's lab, and meanwhile, the Magisterium is preparing for an all-out assault. I mean, these guys have, like, semi-automatic weapons. They're just... I mean, this scene was kind of terrifying. Because I never really thought of the Magisterium as... the military force, but obviously they are well armed and ready to go. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of back and forth in this sequence at the end of the episode, so it's a little jumpy between worlds. But Will is beginning to read the letters back in his apartment when he hears the door of the house open. He turns off the light in his bedroom, getting in hides, and gets ready for the intruder. Thomas and the other guy whose name I never caught.
Me neither. He's just like creepy, like more stakeout-y dude. Like
that. Yeah, dude. I have no idea who this other guy is. Mm-hmm. What his name is. Sorry. I know who he is, but I don't. So my apologies to this actor. As far as I'm concerned, he's just an unnamed character. Mm-hmm. They come back into the apartment to look around, and you know, they were interrupted during their original search, so they're back now thinking that Will and Elaine are gone. They hear the noise of Will and follow it. Thomas finds him first, and Will attacks him.
Well, let's slow down. Did he attack him, really? Because he kind of, like, fainted like he was about to. Jimmy Brooks, not with the best fighting skills, a.k.a. my guy Will Perry. I mean, he just, like, kind of pops out. And then it's like, oh, is he going to hit him? But then he doesn't hit him.
Well, he's saved by the cat.
Yeah.
The kitty comes along and does the only thing that this cat can contribute, which is tripping this man.
He's a good cat demon. This guy, Will, has a demon. He doesn't even know it. He's a good cat demon. He doesn't even know he has a demon.
And the cat trips Thomas. Thomas falls to his death over the banister. Will escapes. But rather than going to the coach's house, he decides, like, last minute, he's approaching the house, and then he decides he can't bring this heat. He's now killed a man. He can't bring this heat towards his mom.
He runs
away instead. I'm super worried about Will, because this poor kid, but we should take a moment. Pour one out.
Pour one out.
For our boy Thomas.
Thomas, coder extraordinaire. He cracked so many codes, but now he has perished due to the fierce fighting skills
of a kitty.
We told you, leave the dirty, grimy shit to the other dude. Stick to the white collar stuff. Stick to it. It was ultimately your demise. You didn't know your lane. Stay in your lane, bro. Oh, man.
You did say that several times. You're like, why is Thomas there?
He's out here coding and fucking doing breaking and entries. He's not a breaking and entry dude.
Oh, poor Thomas. I'm going to miss him a little bit. How are we going to get our internet theories to Boreal?
No more Reddit threads, no subreddits. It's all over for freaking Boreal. He's done.
Oh, poor Thomas. Okay, so back in Lyra's world, Lyra and Roger enter Azrael's lab. Before that, Yorick tells them that he's going to tell the guards, which are bears, to stand down since he's the king now. Roger and Lyra share a quick hug before they go inside. And they're met by this guy that I didn't recognize. Are we supposed to know him?
Yeah, he's they're met by Azrael's like manservant. Like the guy who's in the beginning of the first episode. It's how long it's been since we've seen them. He's the one who grabs the film and puts it on the film when they're up inside the lab.
Yeah. Okay, that's right. Yeah. Okay, I was a little confused about how he knew Lyra, but you know, he lets them in because he knows Lyra. Azrael seems literally devastated that Lyra's even there. He says, I did not send for you. He says that multiple times. You have to turn around and leave. He is not at all happy to see her. He's really upset.
Why is she there? But again, here this guy is being the best dad ever. He's winning all kinds of dad awards. He's like, I didn't send. He's like, no, no. He's literally screaming out, no, I didn't send for you. The minute he lays eyes on her. And she's like there to try to save him and break him out and give him the elite theometer.
Huh. Yeah, this guy is so single-minded. We'll talk about this in a moment. Stelmaria notices, who is, we haven't seen Azrael in a while, so to remind our listeners, that is a snow leopard demon of Azrael's. She notices Roger and alerts Azrael, who is so excited to see him. He tells Roger that he's very pleased that he came with Lyra. And Lyra is looking at him really frightened. Like, what is going on here? And that's the end of the episode. The last scene we see is Azrael looking at Roger in a way that I can only describe as like he's about to like eat him for dinner.
Yeah, like it was like he looks like cooked food. He's like, oh yeah, I'm looking at him like food.
It, It was pretty gross. And what I liked about the way it was framed was Lyra was standing behind Azrael, and she's like not stunned, but she's concerned about his interest in Roger. So she's already on guard about this. I'm worried about Roger. Just put that there.
Because she went Azrael went right from no, leave, why are you here, to like super happy. It's like he went from like super like upset to super happy in like less than 2 seconds. It was wildly crazy. I would be nervous too.
Yeah, I just, Azrael is awful. And now I know that Mrs. Coulter is the main antagonist of the show, but can we just talk about the difference in their reunions? Like, as soon as Mrs. Coulter sees Lyra again after Lyra's escape, she's like happy to see her. She's genuinely moved. She tries to have this mothering moment that turns into manipulation. It's just, I don't know. To have Azrael immediately be like, no, why are you here? I mean, I know that he is worried about the danger, right? But it just, I don't know. Can you say what's up to your daughter first, who just obviously traveled quite some distance to be with you, who's arriving basically by herself with another child? Can you have a like a human moment with her before you start yelling? I mean, I just, he wasn't, oh, Azrael, I missed him, but not really. No,
I have stayed true to myself this whole time, to the true north. I am not a fan. I mean maybe there'll be something that'll change my mind at some point, but man, I just feel like every chance he gets to kind of like show you his humanity, he's so singularly focused on bringing down the Magisterium that he's actually becoming the thing that he hates. Like, he's actually becoming like the thing that has destroyed this whole world. And I get wanting to like take vengeance towards people who've taken your land, you know, destroyed, you know, had you go on the run because, you know, you killed somebody and in self-defense, all those things. I get him being like really, like having that desire, but you just can't treat your daughter like that right off the jump, man. Come on.
Yeah, it was really disappointing. I felt so bad for Lyra because she has gone through so much so that she can bring him something that she thinks is a weapon that might save him. Yeah. And this is the way he treats her. And then he's looking at her friend like, he, like, I don't know, that was like a scary look that he was giving him. It was just tough reunion for Lyra and Azrael, who maybe, I don't know, she should have never been looking for her in the first place.
No, she should not. I agree. I'm with you. What do you think about the Will's whole situation? I guess we kind of went over that a little bit. But like, how do you think this plays out, and what do you think is going on with him?
I mean, poor Will is such a victim of circumstance. He, you know, Lyra is an adventure seeker. And so, yes, Lyra's been through a lot, and she's obviously the child in the prophecy. And so you expect her to encounter a lot of danger. Will is just living a normal teenage boy life, like trying to get by, trying to take care of his mom, trying to go to school. And all of these dark forces start interfering in his life to the point where he ends up killing someone. Mm-hmm. And that's for anyone, whether it's accidental or not, because I don't know that Will actually in this scene meant to kill Thomas. I think he was probably trying to just push him away so he could run. But like, he has to live with that for the rest of his life, that a man died because of his actions, even though that man was there to do harm. I don't think that Thomas would have killed either of them, to be honest. So I just, this whole thing Thomas that happened
wouldn't hurt anything. Thomas should not have been there. Okay. He got killed by a kitty cat. A little kitty cat killed him. Thomas wasn't going to hurt him or the cat or anything else. That other dude, though, that was the thing. Like, I think Thomas was the sacrificial lamb, and I think Will is in a bad situation. Like you said, all these people end up being casualties, oddly enough, of a war that's taking place in a world that they don't even know exists. and that basically has been brought together because of people like Boreal and Grumman and Mrs. Coulter and Azrael. Like, these people who are, like, kind of, like, they're in the middle of these things that don't really, don't ultimately concern them directly until they find out that they do, you know?
Mm-hmm. I did want to talk a little bit about the Magisterium forces preparing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys look like stormtroopers. Like, they're well-armed. They look like some kind of special forces division. I'm a little bit concerned that the show hasn't, like, the Magisterium should be the main antagonist.
Yeah.
And up until this point, they've been like a side antagonist, like clearly pulling the strings, but Mrs. Coulter has become the central villain. I guess I just, I'm terrified about when the Magisterium finds Lyra, because I think that they're clearly very well armed. She doesn't have the Egyptians with her anymore. I'm really concerned about the fact that it's going to be like Lyra, Yurik, maybe Lee, and Azrael against the Magisterium. I think obviously the witches are still in play, right?
And the bear army. They have all the bears. Like,
oh, that's bear. Right. Yeah. That's true. They do have all the bears. I kind of well, a couple of things. There are hundreds of bears. We only saw like a dozen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think the show did a real disservice by only showing that fight in the throne room, where I believe in the book it is in front of the palace and all the bears are there.
In the book, it's in like an arena, like a stadium full of
bears. Oh, okay.
Yeah, like it's like,
yeah, but like it's a big crowd. It's not like 10 dudes in the throne room.
Yeah.
So we didn't really get to see how big the bear force is. I can totally understand is a like a budgeting thing. Yeah. Like, they're not going to render thousands of bears. That's fine. But yeah, the Magisterium actually looks like a force to be reckoned with in a while. We have in a way we haven't seen in a while. I mean, like, we haven't really seen how terrifying their police can be since they raided the Egyptians. I think that was in episode 3. And so to see them like gearing up for battle was pretty terrifying.
It was.
I was like, oh wow, okay, you have guns, like big guns.
Yeah, these are not, yeah. I mean, like, we knew that they had like police, but this felt like military issue. This wasn't like you knew, like, when they got on the Egyptian boat, they had the dogs and they were policing and blah blah blah. And I was, but this one felt a little bit heightened. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, no, this definitely felt like a tactical team.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it should be interesting to see how that plays out next episode. I mean, this sequence was pretty short, even though a lot of stuff happened in it. And we kind of already talked about most of the main parts of it.
Yeah.
I guess I just, I'm so worried about Roger. I'm so worried about Will. I worry less about Lyra because Lyra is crafty and seems to have the ability to get out of pretty much every bad situation.
Including
but I'm
falling
really
out of a balloon from a million feet in the sky. Like she's also able not to get hurt or die or break her bones. Yeah, no, I'm with you.
Yeah, but I'm concerned about the two boys in, you know, in the show, Roger and Will. I feel terrible about what Will has gone through. I also feel badly that he's basically going to be a fugitive. I mean, had he gone to the authorities, maybe he could say, like, this was an accident, like, this person was robbing our house, but, like, because he ran, he's going to be under suspicion. So I feel sorry for Will.
I do too. So let's get to this. What do you like? What do you question? What do you want to see more of?
So what I liked mostly was, you know, the beauty, the way that the show's crew is incredible. Yeah. I mean, everything just looks great. The bears looked great. Their fight, even though part of it was obscured, was still pretty awesome. I would have liked them to be in armor, but I thought, you know, what we had was great. The way the bear palace looked was great. The snowy, you know, galloping through the snow lovely. Really liked that. I questioned a lot of things in this episode. I think, you know, I told you this was my least favorite of the whole season. I really didn't love this. I will say that giving them the benefit of the doubt, let's say that, well, actually, we'll just go out of seven episodes. I was going to say out of all eight. If this is the worst episode of seven, and it's the only one that left me kind of like, I didn't love this. I didn't absolutely hate it, but it was definitely a letdown for me in a lot of ways. That's fine. Like, every show has an episode or two that can be difficult or boring or whatever. This show has delivered week by week in so many ways. And so, fine. They had an episode that was not for everybody. I didn't love it. But the reasons I didn't love it were all questions that I had from early, the things that I just felt like didn't get set up. Yeah. So I didn't like the way the bear fight was set up. I didn't like the cutting back and forth between the worlds. Like, it was really jarring. Mm-hmm. 1 minute we're in our world, then we're seeing Boreal cost. Then we're like, it was a lot. The cutting from the Magisterium conversation between Fra Pavel and Father Garrett to the very next scene, which was Mrs. Coulter and Father McPhail. Those conversations could have been condensed. We didn't actually need to see all the Magisterium forces in terms of, like, the priest getting ready to go up north. Like, that felt really unnecessary to me. And we're starting to see some of the cracks in the storyteller earlier. The Magisterium, whenever we go there, feels so like it's pulling us out of the story because they haven't done enough work to make the link between the story, what's happening to Lyra, and the Magisterium's role in it. Mrs. Coulter has been mainly the stand-in for the Magisterium's cruelty, but these people are actually, like, worse than Mrs. Coulter. She mm-hmm. wouldn't be doing this if it weren't, they didn't give her a license to do it. So I was a little frustrated with that. I also thought, okay, the scene where Lyra goes to meet with Yofur for the first time, Pan is not in that scene, right? That's great. He shouldn't be. Because she's going to say she's a demon, so she can't have a demon mm-hmm. as well. But I didn't even notice at first Pan wasn't there because there have been so many scenes where we don't see the demons.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now something that I think in our first episode, I was like, oh, it's not that big of a deal that the demon stuff is a little bit inconsistent, feels like a huge deal to me because this is not just about the underlying connection between the demons and the people. It's that the absence of her demon should have been really jarring.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. Yeah. It was because there have been other scenes where Pan is just not present or doesn't have a voice or, like, is in the background but with no purpose. So all of those things that frustrated me, they frustrated me because I just felt like this was stuff that could have been avoided. And obviously I really questioned the decision to have Lyra fall out of the balloon last episode and then to have her wake up on, like, 5 inches of snow. Like, I just, what? Why? 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 Like, we had a snowstorm in New York City on Wednesday night, and I'm pretty sure we had almost as much snow. It was not that serious. School was not canceled.
Yeah.
People went about their business.
Yeah, like a little wind, you know, get a little snow blower, you're fine. You don't even need a shovel. It's like, that's how it was. Yeah, she definitely, that was tough. That was super tough. I guess what I like.
Oh, wait, before you go in, let me just say what I'm looking forward to.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually, beyond the plot, I'm actually just looking forward to how they wrap this, given that they introduced Will and his family so early.
Yeah.
I'm really curious to see how they're going to get us ready for season two, which we know is already filming.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I'm looking forward to most, is just how the storytelling all kind of comes together in the finale next week. Given that we have these multiple stories that have to converge, or I would assume they don't have to converge, but I would assume that at some point they're going to converge next week. I would think probably in the last scene, that's what we'll see, Will and Lyra's stories becoming connected somehow.
Yeah, I think that's a good call. And we had spoken about that, like, once they introduced him, like, we spoke about that weeks ago, like, what we thought would happen there. You know, I really like Yurik getting his throne back. I really like the aspects of in the story when he comes and that, like, almost serendipitously, he ends up in a spot where it's not even about the throne or what he would have calculated to figure out how to get his kingdom back through circumstance and his love of Lyra and this idea, again, of destiny. He ends up back in his kingdom, like, not even pushing to go there, and in a situation where he's going to have the opportunity, where Lyra actually did him a great service by giving him single combat as the opportunity to win back his kingdom versus having to figure out how would he fight an army? How would he raise an army? How would he just so single combat now is the way he does it. Just the way that all plays out for him. Really one of my favorite parts of the episode and really of the story. I really, you know, because I'm a big Yurik Myrnison fan, so I really like that. I question the pacing of this whole season. I question it. I've reserved, like, judgment, and then this episode is where I saw that I kept trying to say, well, you know, it's kind of crazy that they're moving this fast, but I could understand why you could introduce certain characters till later and all those other things, and I made a lot of, like, concessions. But I really do question it in this episode because it's one of the reasons why we're losing some of the backstory to some of the characters and the ability to build upon what it is they need to do to make some of the things that we all know, book readers will know are coming or maybe perceive are coming because they've been making some changes. I just feel like there's a lot of work that they've left not there. Chiefly, you know, the backstory between Yurik and Yurfor should have created a way more tense moment between them because it almost should have felt more like Clegane Bowl. You know what I mean? We all waited for Clegane Bowl and then it happened, even though that was a little anticlimactic in the end too. But it made sense that we would be waiting for that because of all the work they did of them in the first season and then talking about it throughout other seasons. So I was really questioning that. I kind of feel like if what I want to see more of is really less about this season, and I guess we'll talk next season, is I really want them to commit to the fact, and maybe it's network considerations or otherwise, that you're going to tell this whole story. And if you're going to tell this whole story, you don't need to go at this breakneck speed, and you have a chance to really build some really nice things that could have been shown throughout this whole season in the next season. So hopefully they'll do that. They'll slow down a little bit and they'll figure out, like, how to really build out the things that make this story really magical about the different types of people, the different worlds that they created and that Pullman created, and the way that each of these characters really have their own reasons. They've done it really well in some cases with smaller characters having better motivations in the script, but they've lost some things also by just sheer the amount that they're trying to get into each episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what I'm seeing here is this show is really character driven, and I didn't love this episode because it was so plot driven, but then it just felt like it was plot for plot's sake. I'm not clear that if we just sort of quizzed people who have been watching the show that they understand the underlying themes of the story. And I think that that's, I don't know. I just feel like towards the end of The Golden Compass, when I read the book, I started to understand what Pullman was trying to talk about in terms of, you know, what we talked about last week, like free will and the ability to sin and make mistakes. And that's part of being human. Mm-hmm. And I'm just feeling like after they did great work in, you know, exposition with that, yes, last week, I almost said yesterday, that's so funny, it was really missing from this episode in terms of what the theme just doesn't feel consistent. I don't know, the only mention of dust in this episode was when Mrs. Coulter basically said that you know, she understands it, which I also think is bull. I don't see that Mrs. Coulter understands dust any more than the Magisterium probably does. She obviously believes that it's linked to sin, but are we sure that's what it means? You know, I just, this was a little disappointing, but I'm overall, I just think that there's so many good things about the show. Like the acting is just extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, just really, really good. And it's really nice to see some of the actors really grow, like Roger from episode one to now. Is a totally different, not different character, but is more convincing. I feel like the actor got stronger as they went. You know, even Lin-Manuel, the way he's playing Lee now, he toned it down a little bit. I like that. Mm-hmm. I actually thought it was good that he was the comic relief in the beginning, but I like that he's taken a more somber tone. Like, I think Hester made a joke and he kind of was like, we're stuck here. like this is serious business. But so there were some great things about the episode. I just, it was a little bit of a letdown to go through this part with the Yopher Yorick conflict being resolved, because I just, it didn't feel earned. It felt like it wasn't built up enough.
Well, yeah, agree. And I think, like, honestly, and I get they can't, they didn't feel like they could do it, maybe. I don't know why they didn't feel like they can do it. Maybe there's more production stuff that we'll never have, you know, information on. But legitimately, we could have went through, there's so much stuff in the book that they could have got through this whole season and not even gotten to the bear fight yet. You know what I mean? Like, not yeah. even gotten to the things that we're getting to. Not even gotten to Asriel's lab and, like, what's going on. They could have gotten so far down the road. Like, the whole thing could have, the whole season, legitimately, could have culminated with the kids being freed from Bolvanger. And the Egyptians, mm-hmm. and the Egyptians leaving, and that being the end. Like, we could have ended there. Like, there's so much things that could have happened, so many pieces that have rich backstory that I feel like they're speeding through, and it's almost like the cliff notes to the story. You know what I mean? So that was a concern of mine when I saw how much they were compressing into episodes, and it's played. I think this episode was the one where it really played out, where it really was like, okay, this is now starting to feel really rushed, the way that you just handled that.
Right, especially because we know as an audience that there's only one after this.
Yep.
So that's a little nerve-wracking. Like, a lot has to happen. And also, they introduced stuff from the second book. So some work has to be done there, too. I'm a little nervous about them compressing all of that into 1 hour. But, you know, they have done a pretty good job of weaving together Will's narrative. Well, originally it was Boreal's narrative, which seemed a little off track, but then they brought it back into focus with Will. So let's, you know, I'm excited to see what they do. Okay. I hope they're able to kind of bring it together. And I'm just really glad to know that the second season is a sure thing.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing's ever a sure thing, right, until they announce the dates, but they're already filming it. So they're not going to spend all that money and then just trash it. So I'm excited to see where the show goes in the future. But they definitely, I hope, are building more on the overall themes of Pullman's world and doing, there's some of these new, like some of the other worlds that Lyra eventually will be exposed to are really complicated, and the magic is kind of out there. So I think it will be interesting to see how they build those blocks and build out those worlds.
I agree. I totally, totally agree. So I guess here's what we'll do. I hope we're going to be, like, after next season, I mean, after next episode, we're going to be wrapping on this season of our podcast and talking about what's upcoming next, making announcements about all that. But it will be a kind of recap episode. So if you guys have questions or things that you liked about the story or things that you wanted to see or ideas, please reach out to us at kinfolklore@gmail.com. Definitely go leave reviews there. But more importantly, reaching out through the email with any of your questions. We want to be able to even bring some of your questions into the show and kind of shout you out there and all that. You got anything else, Andrew?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Well, have a great holiday, and thank you for joining us again. We'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week. Bye.